Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and hopefully after over 350 episodes, you know what this podcast is about. But if you're new to it, then let me tell you that My Time Capsule is a podcast where people tell me five things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish and one thing that they'd like to bury and forget. My guest in this episode is someone I've admired for a long time, the Scottish actor Lewis MacLeod. Now, you may not necessarily know Lewis's face, but you will certainly know one of his many voices, from countless adverts and playing roles such as Sir Bulba from Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, and also Postman Pat, and of course various characters in 64 Zoo Lane. He regularly appeared on BBC Radio 2 Steve Wright in the afternoon, voicing impressions of Donald Trump, Jeremy Vine, an extraordinary impersonation, and Paul McCartney. He's also famous for his amazing impressions on the BBC's Dead Ringers and ITV's Newsoids of people like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Christopher Walken, Gordon Brown, Boris Johnson, and George Galloway. And that just scratches the surface. Lewis also voiced Draco Malfoy, Albus Dumbledore, Fred Weasley, and George Weasley in various Harry Potter video games. Since 2018, he's voiced the character of Ramon Tarmin on Clinton Baptiste's Comedy Paranormal podcast, alongside the wonderful Alex Lowe. They recently toured a live stage version together, which was a huge hit. Lewis reprised his role as Sir Bulba in numerous Star Wars video games, and also played Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi in many. In fact, he's done so many amazing recordings and voices that there are just too many to list. But knowing Lewis, I'm pretty sure you'll hear some of them as we talk about his life and the five things from it he'd like to have in a time capsule. Here is the delightful Lewis MacLeod. How are you? All right, where are you?
I'm very well. I'm in a very rain-drenched Scotland. The weather has been almost biblical. It's neighbours building arcs. We had that.
Yes, it was very strong, wasn't it? I mean, I'm down in the southeast, and we got it as well. I mean, that's not in the agreement.
No. I know the quotient of pools. You've got when you see swimming pools in Lower England, you think
yes. Well, we English people chose the southeast of England and said everything else happens elsewhere.
This is not in the brief. It's not.
not on the schedule.
I've had a word with my man. And he's crossing the border to examine the area.
Weather brokers have arrived. We'll be back with you after the hurricane.
Yeah, it sometimes feels like that, actually, watching the weather, doesn't it? You think, you lucky bastards. That's me.
Scotland, like football, whenever we get a summer that the weather is just good, it's such a lovely feeling, you know.
Yes.
Probably happened once in 100 years. But
beautiful place, though. Gorgeous.
Yep, absolutely.
And I cannot understand. I was talking to my brother yesterday about the prospect of the Labour Party winning the next election. And I said, well, it doesn't really matter what happens in this country. What really matters is that Labour win in Scotland.
Yeah, well, the SNP mired and all that crazy stuff. And there's a lot of nicknames for the one I heard the other day, it's like somebody'd written me a line for Trump. Hazmat useless. Who is this guy? He gives me the heebie-jeebies, you know. He's more anxious than Joe Biden reading the obituaries.
It's extraordinary. I don't know. I mean, I think that actually, what I can't understand, and I thought this for a long time, Lewis, see what you think of this theory, that if the Conservative Party want to stay in power, what they need to do is persuade Scotland to leave, because the Labour Party entirely rely on the Scottish vote to gain power. They couldn't win in this country if it wasn't for the Scottish vote.
I mean, they're hardly going to do a coalition, though, are they?
No.
It's... I think the problem, again, I mean, it ties in with what I do, is you look for kind of charisma, really. You look for something in them that that's mimicable. I mean, I saw it in Boris when he was mayor. It just seemed when he, you know, became prime minister, it all went to pot, you know. But he, I'd turn up at functions and see this guy getting on the stage, and the place was in an uproar, and I thought, wow, I don't think I've ever seen a politician as popular.
No.
And as funny. And I don't think we've had that up here. I mean, we used to joke that, you know, with Nicola Sturgeon, you know, happy birthday, Nicola. Look, the people of Scotland, I just wish you a happy birthday. You know, there's something about, they just don't seem to garner much affection. And that's a shame. And it could be the training they've got, that they're never wrong. They'd never met, you know, I was thinking of Michael Howard, you know, did you?
Yeah.
That quality in there just prohibits them from being likable. And I feel that that's, we've just not got that one person, you know, a Billy Connolly politician, you know, hello, here I am in politics. Politics. It's a very scary place. That's it. I just need somebody that...
The power of a national treasure. That's what you need.
Exactly that.
Which I'm going to put you in that category.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, no, come on. I think, I mean, and I don't care if the others listen to this. I think you're the best. I do think you're the best.
You've just made me so many enemies with that.
Yeah, I know. Well, tell him he cut the bit out where I said no, and I praised you. You could say that bit.
It's the one area, you know, when you're a mimic, there's really not many of us. And
no.
Rory Bremner was a heroic figure in mimicry for me, because he was so instrumental in kind of formulating that, you know, career path, and then got to meet him in 1990 when I was sort of nascent comic and all that. But he was so helpful and he was so encouraging. And I think he probably felt the same, that there's not many of us. There's like a mimic family, I've heard it referred to, that we're all very supportive of each other, although we've set our stall up. And, you know, John Culshaw is brilliant, and he sort of, you know, we all have a different tone about how we do a certain voice. But Rory was really... He was so forensic that it kind of blew my mind, you know, and I was thinking, how does, you know, like an opera singer, how do you do that? And wanted to study it and just unconsciously started doing that, you know?
Right. Oh, that's amazing. Actually, I remember Rory coming backstage when we did a live show of Radioactive, which is the thing I used to do on Radio 4, and nobody knew who he was.
Right.
And he came back this very shy, quiet, intelligent, charming man. And we said, well, we're going to the pub, you're coming. And he came and he does the most amazing impersonation. And then the whole evening was taken up with us going, do another one. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. It is a funny thing, isn't it? It's like, I've heard it, good and bad, that it could be seen as tricksy, or there's a kind of magic trick element to it. But I just naturally, because my brothers are both mimics. Well, Callum sadly passed away, but he was really funny. He had that, he'd no filter. And so combined with the ability to find the tune of the voice, he could really nail it, you know. But it's a funny thing. It's a sort of unconscious thing. I can't help myself now. It's almost, it's... It's an automatic, it's like blinking.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it is difficult because it does take you over, doesn't it? And, yeah. You know, I mean, the only impersonations I've ever done in my life, I think I've impersonated two people by singing like them a bit. But some of the impersonations you do are so convincing and so exact that they're really disturbing. I mean, Jeremy Vine, you did that on the radio for God knows how long, and people still swore it was Jeremy Vine doing it as a joke.
Well, I don't get recognised by the face, but, you know, what do you do for a living, son? In the back of the cab. Oh, well, I do impersonations. Hang on a minute. Have you heard that guy that does Jeremy Vine on Steve Wright? And then it would start. And I had so many wonderful cab journeys in London. Yeah. The laughter it brought and can bring is great fun. That's why I guess that's the drug of doing it, it can bring a lot of laughter to people. And Jeremy himself, such a great sport. And he said to Ken Bruce, who I listened to on your show, who was so good, Ken, and he said, well, I'm beginning to sound like Lewis's impersonation of me, which I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but...
That's amazing, though, isn't it? He does get some stick, doesn't he? Terrible stick.
Yeah, I think there's some of the items, though, that are hilarious. I mean, there was one about Christmas trees, flammable Christmas trees.
And this lady was talking about the Christmas tree, and she said, well, I mean, the whole thing, I went through and had my dinner, smelt this burning, and the whole place was nearly ablaze.
And it was just the idea that it was Swiss tea lights for these Christmas trees were causing a problem, and that became the item on the show. Well, I was in the car, I nearly crashed because I was crying, because the guy they brought on was J.K. He's such a laughing. Jeremy's got no place. This is a serious item. Yes, you're right, it is. But it wasn't. It was just the way it was presented was so ridiculous.
Yeah, those ridiculous segues that they do.
Exactly. Here's Toto in Africa. That's what we just always segued into prog rock or an 80s trope song. You know? And it's always bless him, he means it. You know, and we send our deepest condolences to the family of the man who jumped off the roof of the Shard. Here's Van Halen and jump.
I also understand when you say it can be a bit of a curse that you have this ear that hears it, you know, as a tune. That's an interesting thing. I'd not thought of it that actually the voice also hearing the tune of the voice.
Well, that was Lynn Ferguson. She said to me, this is 20 years ago, Lynn, great comic or great writer, her brother Craig Ferguson, obviously, he was the predecessor to James Corden on the Saturday show.
Yeah, he's been on here.
Yeah, well, she said to me, basically the part she cast me in was given, he couldn't say no. And I remember she sat us all around and all he had to say was, thinking about it, and yes. And she said, ostensibly, he's the cleverest character in the piece. And I burst out laughing and offended her. I said, he's only got two things to say. And she explained to me afterwards, she said he has a real problem with saying no, and that this was somehow divisive and that it would cause argument. And he was always trying to placate. And I thought, I really got that. And I thought, okay. So but I was playing him as a dullard, And she recast me. I thought, how humiliating. I've literally got two words to say and I've been recast. And swept over was this actor. She said, yes, of course. She said, you've got to get this right. And she said, you're not getting the tune of the voice. She said, speech is music. And I went, all right. And that was a light going on, actually. It made mimicry a lot easier, a lot quicker for me to sort of see it as music, because I would literally sing the words and in a weird way to get the tone that was most consistent with their voice. And obviously it gets complicated when you're doing people like Christopher Walken, because, you know, the tone changes and it goes everywhere. But Obama was one that I utilized that theory. It was like, the note, you know, just getting a little note made it a little quicker for me, you know.
Ah, that's fascinating. How extraordinary. But then again, the curse of the fact that you are a really good actor and people then say, well, what voice are you going to do? And you go, well, I thought I'd do mine.
Ah, well, we still get that in voiceover, you know, when you're, because I was always told when I started doing this, I was essentially sponsored by David Jansen, who was married to Debbie Arnold at the time, and they helped me so much, and I love them so dearly for that. They gave me a real start in London. They said, you've got to do this, you know, the straight read, which was a sort of heightened version of the received pronunciation. So in an English MVO, male voiceover voice, was the sound that I had to attain. So I would go into sessions with a Scottish accent and the client would turn around and say, ah, right, okay. Ah, MacLeod, and you're Scottish. Okay, well, and I say, no, but hang on. You know, I can do the English accent. But in protesting that, I would sound more Glaswegian. You know, wait a minute, hang on a minute. Just give me a chance here. And okay, Lewis, in you go. So I had to, I think it was Aileen Moore actually said to me, if you ever get a voiceover, do the English accent first. Mm. It just beds in easier and you'll have practiced that more than your own accent.
It's funny, isn't it? That's Hugh Laurie went for the audition for House and just decided to go in and do an American accent. And they were convinced that he was American. Somebody said to him, you do a great Brit accent. It's just amazing.
Wow. So he must have been in the part off stage, off camera.
And he was all day
all
long.
All day long. Wow.
All day long. Lunch and everything. Never stopped doing the accent. Imagine. Drive you mad.
Aye, that's because I can switch it on and off fairly easily, I think. But you can't. I think that's another benefit. When you're doing, you know, scripts that are, you're only in for an hour, you get to sort of ad lib, think fast, and then you can shut it down and go on with your day.
Yeah, yeah. And the same with Dead Ringers, that thing of having to switch from one character to another. Is there a little hook that you think of before you say it?
Ah, well, yeah, for Boris there was, because I think it was when we were doing Private Eye Live. Again, the writing's so good. I think it was P-W-W-A-H-H. And I think ostensibly it would have just been pa. But I said, no, wait a minute. I said, if I can run with this. And so came up with this whole kind of... black belt Boris. Because, of course, he was doing that anyway. He was less extended to that, but he was thinking through what he was going to say. That's slight stuttered. I, thinking. Mm. Then he would say what he has to say.
He's almost a character out of Vicar of Dibley sometimes, isn't he? When he goes, no, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It does... I think Peter Serafinovich, when he was doing Alan Alda, he does the best Alan Alda. You've got to hear that. You know, and he would use the words, it's preposterous, it's ridiculous, it's ludicrous. And he would use these three words to get into the thing. So you're absolutely right. There are words, well, Farage, it's no, let me speak. And then we're away. No, let me speak. The problem with that voice is, of course, he reads so quickly, I've made a rod for my own back. And then you sort of laugh through the lines, but then get very serious. So there are definitely, you can invent a word or a sound that does assist you to get them thinking about it.
Yeah, fascinating. It's a brilliant skill. And as you say, there are so few people who can do it. Everybody tries.
Well, I think to make a living out of it, I was very lucky because I genuinely had the... It's like, you know, one of these Kenny Williams talking about, you got his dad going, you've got to get a trade, son. You've got to get a trade. Well, my father was a cop and I would have been a fourth generation had I joined. And I went in to see the careers officer. And over about a year and a half, he saw that I was doing productions at school and I was tinkering around recording stuff. And he eventually talked me out of doing it and joining. He said, follow that mimicry thing. He said, that's funny. And I'm glad he did sort of support me in that, because it is a profession that, you know, voiceovers. I was doing work in Glasgow, bits here and there, but I didn't realise the scale of it until I went to London. That actually, you know, there's a community of voiceovers. There's a, it's a big family. But mimicry was something that, with the emergence of the satellite channels and doing animation, and I started getting more work, and I was probably at that age, I was more malleable, you know, I was in my mid-20s and I was able to run about, and, you know, I could, cartoons were certainly something that I could do very easily, you know, but the range goes down slightly, you know, you know, it sort of drops a bit, and it's probably because I've been doing crazy sounds over the years, you know.
Yeah, quite.
Dinosaurs.
A little bit gruffer.
It does, you know. But I think it... It was certainly moving to London and that widened my horizons with that. And I thought I could actually just focus on this as a career, because I didn't train. I could have gone to school and, you know, and become an actor more than I am, but I just kept working, really.
It's very difficult to turn it down, isn't it? To decide, you know, I'm going to take time away from it and do a project or do a television recording. It's hard. People would say, well, surely that's going to be lucrative, but it doesn't compare with the world of voiceovers, or certainly not the world of voiceovers that I once knew.
Oh, darling. But yeah, the halcyon days.
Yes.
It's nice when you get a telly job off the back of doing a voiceover. You know, right. that can be quite, you know. I heard you on that program and I thought you'd be good for this, you know.
I heard you in a voiceover and I decided you could play a strawberry.
I've been a talking door. Do you ever do that thing? There's nothing, in anything in anybody's house that I haven't sold at some point or another.
Yes. You know? I know. I was once actually got the note, could you sound more like a blackcurrant? That happens in the world of Ribena. They get carried away, don't they?
Yes.
Anyway, there we are. Right. So we need to talk about some things that you're going to put in a time capsule, if you've chosen some.
Yes, I have. Well, the first one comes as a bundle, because I seem to recall it was a bundle when it was bought. My parents bought a Sanyo Betamax video recorder. There was a VIC-20 computer, Commodore VIC-20, and a cassette player. And those three things sort of set me on my path, really. You know,
did you just rob a bank?
No, exactly. I think Fraser's did a deal.
Oh, no, of course he was a copper. No, sorry, there was always money coming in. I know.
If you don't give me that Betamax recorder, you know. Yeah, I think it was paying the HP off until about 1997. It was a kind of weird time because VHS was the popular format. So, of course, my father came in with this Betamax. We're all like, what the hell's this? But it had a little kind of connector at the back. It said mic out. So I plugged in speakers and turned it into a microphone. And I do remember this on a Christmas day, hearing this laughter from up the stairs. And what had happened was my father had taken the cassette and was wanting to play Torvald and Dean's Bolero, which is iconic, you know. And he said, my brother was wanting to be a rock star. And he's going, you know, wait, no, you've got to see this. This is Ravel's Bolero. But wait till you see the two of them on the ice rink. It's amazing. Margaret, where's that tape? And he gets the tape, puts it in. But of course, what had happened was I'd come in from school and was dicking around with the video recorder and stuck the mini jack into this wee hole in the back of the machine and turned the speaker into a microphone and started dubbing, I think it was Annika Rice on Channel 4, on this tape. So by sheer luck, I stopped recording just as he went, and here they go onto the ice rink with Ravel's Bolero after their previous sensational performance. And it brought the house down. And I think, although it could have gone very badly for me because he loved that recording and played it continually, I didn't realise the importance of what that was. It was my first ever funny dub onto cassette. But I had been taping programmes, like TV shows, on audio cassette to listen to, like Kenny Everett and anything before we had video. And, you know, I was always doing something, recording on something to try and you know, just understand it better and obsess about it. But the video recorder was really brilliant because then we all got the chance to sort of play it back and I could study it more. And the video, the VIC-20, again, I started getting into that in a way because there's a comedian called Simon Munnery who's been around for a while. And Simon, when he was about 16, wrote a video game for the VIC-20 on the unexpanded memory VIC-20, which was 3K RAM, which is nothing. It's like a photograph on your phone. And he came up with this video game, and it was a beauty. It was like Space Invaders, and I remember it was called Cosmades. And I got really taken by this because in those days, you might remember, you know, when you bought the magazines to accompany these home computers, they always gave you code at the back. You could actually type in a game. And it took hours because if you got one character wrong, the thing went to pot, you know. But, you know, I started studying and I kind of figured out how to make a sort of game. So I could have become a programmer as well.
Yes.
Age 13.
Well, really rich.
I know, exactly. What a failed career. This is terrible. This is heartbreaking, you know. But it was just such a creative time from about 1981 through to about 85, 86. I think that's when I, you know, with all these gadgets knocking around, I sort of formed, guess what I'm doing now?
Yeah.
And then I remember going to the cinema in 1984, having really now got into mimicry. I was always mimicking the teachers at school and making the class laugh and all this stuff. But going to the cinema, and I think it was Romancing the Stone. It was a double feature, Romancing the Stone and Johnny Dangerously. And I remember hearing this trailer guy in a world, imagine a time. And I thought, who's that? I want to do that. And that, that stuck with me. And so when I got the chance to actually be the trailer guy, it came after a lot of cigarettes and alcohol around the age of 38. You know, going in at 9 a.m. when I was talking like this. Hello there, good morning.
The earlier the better.
The earlier the better. You book me at 4 a.m. The words will come out backwards and it'll be, but it'll be the right tone. And oh, that's like Yoda.
Feature film thriller you will watch.
But I really always wanted to be that guy, and to get the chance to do it was really cool. You know,
fantastic. So that teacher was right then. What an amazing thing. I mean, nearly every teacher in the history of teaching would have said to you, cut that out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They gave you something to wait for at the end of term. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it was the first. Ladies and gentlemen, please close your copybooks for Lewis McLeod. And, it got me out of a lot of trouble, that, as it does. You hear this from a lot of mimics, you know, that the class comic. It was, I think it was Janet Brown, when she was doing Thatcher. The writer in the writing room, when it can be really tense, and you know, about the phrasing and the scan, and the, you know, just about the gag itself, she would wade in and do Thatcher and just split the room up by breaking the impasse with a bit of comedy, and you know, to use it as a tool. I think I've never really had the chance to do that since school, but it does make people laugh. And I think that's probably the most addictive quality of it, is that it's a recognition laugh layered with hopefully a funny line or the comedy chops.
Yeah, well, it's not enough just to be able to do the voice. It's always impressive when somebody just says the thing back to you and you think that sounds exactly like the person. But your skill is that you can do it, and actually what you say is funny. You've worked with some great writers. You've got a sense and a skill of, like you say, sitting in the writing room. So you would have been there. You would have been with those people saying, it's not quite right. It needs to something.
Yeah, that's a real privilege. That's that's the thing that, you know, somebody like Coogan is magnificent at. Is that it has to be that forensic, and that is the science of the... And the sort of building blocks of it, whereas I'm more haphazard than that, but the being at the table when it really is, especially when it's politics and there's a detail, you know, and I guess, you know, Rory was probably the first mimic to sort of choose that slice of the pie, politics, with John Langdon, the writer, and then Rory obviously writes himself. He's just got that brain, you know, that you can do that now, because I think it was Jeff Atkinson said to me, you know, producer, he said, Lewis, jokes, they're very hard to write. And they are, you know. I think that the marriage between a writer hearing the impersonation and going, right, I can hear Lewis doing that, so then the writing gets a little bit easier, is great as well. It speeds the thing up. And but the writing is, to watch it build is quite spectacular.
Yeah. So I love the fact that from a very early age, you absolutely knew what you wanted to do. How to do it, where to go to do it, or how to make a living out of it wasn't clear. But what you loved doing was exactly what you do now.
I think because there's 9 years between my brothers, there was this watching them at the dinner table and being so funny. And it was, I think, that I thought, oh, this is really clever stuff, and it gave me a chance to kind of observe and assimilate and go, well, okay, let me try my take on it. But I suppose you're right. I think I kind of did know very young that, well, this is making people laugh. I must be good at this. There are downsides to it, and you know, my wife jokes that, you know, you're the youngest, you're the one that doesn't like to share. You know, you're very needy. I'm like, oh, really? But there's all these things that go along with it. But mimicry, to understand subject, is also really interesting. So I learn from mimicking others.
You know, even listening to somebody like Brian Cox, you know, you're picking up.
it beds in better for me to sort of mimic them.
Yeah.
I find that's reading books, actually. I find that I go back and I go back and I go over and over again. definitely on the spectrum, Mike.
It's fantastic. Right, okay, I'm going to put those three things in, clump them together, one item.
Mm.
Okay, so what's number two, Lewis?
Mum's lentil soup. My mother, bless her, she's 86 as of recording, and she... You know, I think that thing of where you could never put your parents in a time capsule. I'm very grateful to have spent longer than most when they, you know, fly the nest from home. My father was ill with cancer, and I was working in London and commuting back and forward, and it was just the mundane Sunday lunch, which I miss so much now, the sitting down with the bowl of lentil soup. And my mother was working, she worked in a local pub, the Wheatsheaf, and she made this lentil soup her own, and the teachers from the school I was at would all pile in, and she actually hated them by the end of it.
These bloody teachers, they keep asking for my lentil soup, they've run out.
But they would come in every day, there was a ton of them would come in the door, it was, there's any lentil soup on? But so there was that work thing, and just the at-home life of sitting home, and my father slurping his soup, he could never eat quietly, but it was just a wonderful thing. It was Sunday lunch, and my mother's graft in making this simple bowl of lentil soup her own. So,
what did she do? Do you know what she did to make it special?
No, I don't know, actually. I mean, it's like the Coca-Cola recipe. It's remained hidden. I think she didn't use any particular... I don't remember telling me, at least, that there was anything special in it. Like, you know, there wasn't any ham. There was a vegetable stock, but she just took her time with it. And she, you know, it's just a great cook overall, really, you know.
It's extraordinary how some people can do that. They do very little with food, but it always ends up tasting fantastic. My wife has that ability to absolutely tell the amounts of ingredients that ought to go in. She never follows a recipe. She reads a recipe and goes, well, that looks good. Mm. And then she puts it down. And then she goes to the oven and she starts cooking. She instinctively knows what the right things to put in are.
Mm.
So your mother must have had that ability, because
you
say to almost anybody, would you like some lentil soup? They go, not really, no.
I know, lentil soup, but I don't know. I mean, I just love it. And it's got that familiarity. There's something lentil soup I'm talking about. But I know it's at Christmas, we go to my brother's for dinner, and one of the family friends, Janet, she'll come in, I've made the lentil soup and it's got ham in it, and you'll shut your face and it'll be lovely. And she knows that my mother makes the lentil soup, so it causes a little bit of contention. But I married a chef. Well, she was once a chef in Paris, and Michelin proper chef, you know.
Wow.
And she learned how to make Cullen skink, and now her family in France are all eating it. But she's made it her own very quickly. But that soup's a thing. This is like that character from Best in Show. What are you doing? I like soup. I'm fully aware that it is lentil soup, but I don't know, it's evocative of a time, again. Of the whole thing, you know.
Clearly, your mother worked in a pub, your father was a policeman, you weren't the laird's boy.
No.
You know, you lived a very, I suppose, what would be described as middle class.
Maybe, I think that's, but the house was semi-detached until 79, and we had a neighbour from hell. We moved to the wee village, and the house was detached. It had patio doors, which my father obsessed about. He'd meet, you know, neighbours at the supermarket and say, come down to the house, you've got to see this. And they go, what the hell's going on? And they'd come down. He said, oh, congratulations on the new house, Ian. Marvellous, wait till you see this. And he'd take them through the back and open this sliding door about 30 times. Look at that. Look at the movement in that. I mean, you can literally slide the door back, you're in the dining room, and look at that, I'm now out the back, and all I need is a wee table here. And when it's not raining, you can sunbathe. Right, Ian, I need to go home now. Thanks. Enjoy your stay. But the pub was, you know, it was there was a family history with the pub, you know, not our history, but my father's old friend owned it, and he gave my mum a job and this, that, and the other. She worked so hard in that little pub and then came home and fed us. And it just, I think it's probably just as a thank you to my mum, really, you know, because she's been a magnificent parent, you know, just. Both of them, mum and dad, you know. So I think it was the Sunday lunch and the pub lunch. It was a nice mix, you know.
Perfect. All right. I'm going to put it in. You made me hungry now.
Yeah. from the boring old lentil soup, ladies and gentlemen. Let's hear it for lentil soup.
That's it. I get that question every afternoon at about 4 o'clock. My wife says to me, what do you want for dinner? And I go, I don't mind anything. What do you want? She said, no, I'm asking you because I can't think of anything. So I know what the answer is today.
Lentil soup.
Yeah.
That's Lentil Soup with their latest song, Ladle.
Lovely. Right, let's move on to number three. Right, unless you're an Acast Plus subscriber where this podcast continues uninterrupted, we are now going to take a short break in the hope that some ads will be played to pay for the making of this podcast. But we'll be back with Lewis as soon as we can. Cheers.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back. Right, let's linger no longer and get straight back to Lewis McLeod and the rest of the things he'd like to have in his time capsule.
Well, I've got here Airborne Forces, which is a broad church, I guess. The Parachute Regiment. Where did I start with this one? Because I met a friend of mine who invited me to a military club. And I didn't know that he had a military history in his family. And it just started something. It gave me something else to think about in my early 30s. And I've become very good friends with a number of retired Parareg guys who, they're just fascinating. They've become really amazing friends. The charities that they're attached to, and there are hundreds of them, they introduced me. I met the King. You know, I met
Charles, yes.
As a result of being... We put a fundraiser on at a local Jazz After Dark on Greek Street, and we supported Combat Stress. And as a result, I got a phone call. There's a letter coming over to you, and it was a letter from, the palace. I was like, oh, my goodness. And I got to meet, it was quite funny because this is true. There was a woman who said, Lewis is the voice of Postman Pat. And the King turns around and he goes... you're the voice of Postman Pat. What does he sound like? And my brain froze. And I said, hello, Mrs. Goggins. And he put his hand up to his nose and he pointed the finger and went, ha, and burst out laughing. And I thought, I've made him laugh. I walked away thinking, my goodness, this is incredible.
The king,
the man. But I've hosted events for them. So I gave a talk, which was hilarious, that it was called a talk. It made it far more intelligent than it was. It was just me standing there, telling jokes and funny stories and this, that. But the friendships I've made with them, they helped me at such, at really dark moments. They shore you up. There's one that springs to mind, Lou, push on. Phrases that are short, succinct, to the point, that really grip you. I'm deeply, eternally grateful to them for I guess their friendship with me and the support they show to civilians, because they are a close-knit group. I went to Arnhem. It's so emotional that weekend. I think this year it's the 80th anniversary commemoration of Operation Market Garden, and I've been twice, and it really was the most beautiful experience. And at moments you're laughing, and then you're crying, and the three languages, the service that they they put on in Arnhem and Oosterbeek is really beautiful. And then the kids come in and they're all given the responsibility at the age of 8 to tend to the graves. So they give them these sunflowers and they put them down and the grave's immaculate. And it's a really beautiful remembrance.
Yeah.
And it really blew my mind. I was with guys who do incredible feats of bravery. And it's also, it's army, and it's not just the airborne forces, the airborne regiments.
No, you think of that, the Market Garden, those young men carrying enormous amounts of weight on their backs and in their packs with their sort of, I'm going to jump out of a plane in a minute, and it's automatically going to open a parachute, and hopefully I'll make it to the ground. Or those gliders, being towed behind aircraft on those gliders and having to come into who knows what in the dark. Mm. And for many of them, absolute disaster, being shot down or being shot in the air, people being killed as they landed, gliders landing in the wrong areas and just people coming out and having so much weight to carry that they just drowned. The people who went through it and survived, they never forget those people who didn't, because they were so close always to being those other people.
Absolutely. We walked into the service and I was with the parachute regiment, Tupara, and there was a man behind me, and obviously the seating is arranged, and I just remember this, I don't know how old he would be, he'd be certainly in his 90s, but he was covered in medals, and he had clogs, these orange clogs on his lapel, and he said, "I've completed my task in life, I have no fear, and I'm ready to meet my God." And it was just, this was just before the service began. This man was talking, he was almost talking above their heads. He had no real interest if anyone was listening or not. It was a lovely moment for me. I was like, who is this guy? But looking at him, he was truly heroic, what he had achieved. Mm. But it was the confidence in his being, his life's journey was complete, he felt. You know, it was really powerful.
That is powerful. I mean, also, whenever you speak to these people, despite the medals demonstrating the enormous heroism of what they've done, they always say, well, I had no choice. I mean, what else was I going to do? And I always think, turn and run? I would. I would have hidden. I would have dug a hole and hidden, I think. I don't know. You don't know what you'd do yourself, but I look at them and think you didn't. You got up and you carried on and you walked on. Now, that may just be training or an extraordinary belief in the thing you're fighting for.
I know. Amidst all this roller coaster of emotions, there's the Bilderberg Hotel, which is just in Oosterbeek. It's just along from the schooner, I think it is. They call the pub. There's pubs that they all meet in, and it's just busy, you know, and really vibrant. And I was working in Scotland, and I booked my hotel the day before, and I thought I was going to be staying in Nijmegen, and here found this room at the Bilderberg. One bedroom left, and this is this significant hotel, and a really important place too. I thought, and it was only like €80, so I took the room, single bed, and staggered back after, you know, the Saturday night, you know, with the lads. And I get to my room, and the next morning I woke up, and the service was beginning at 9:30. I got up fairly early, and I thought, well, I'll get my suit out of my case, and I'll iron it. And I couldn't find an iron in the room, but the bathroom next to the bedroom was huge. And I thought, I'll put my suit in there and my shirt. I'll turn the shower on, steam it up, and just iron out the creases. So I did that, shut the door, and left it for a few minutes, opened the door, and this plumph of steam flew up to the ceiling and set the fire alarm off. So at 7:30 on the Sunday morning, I'm looking out the window, and there's guys getting wheeled out in chairs, you know, berries flopping about. And I'm going, oh no, I'm dead. And, you know, I mean, chaos. And next thing I hear this, from the door. And I'm like, oh, shit. Here we go. Towel around me and I open the door. Your fire alarm, has it just gone off? Yes. Turn it off now. Oh, geez. And so we managed to open the window and get the thing calmed down. By Monday morning, I was in the queue going out the door to check out. And I heard two guys going behind me in really low tones. It was him. You know, my neck shrunk like E.T. and I bolted out the door. So those weekends, I want to go again, I kind of know what to expect really now.
But what an extraordinary thing. I mean, Market Gardens, that's a bridge too far, isn't it?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, in many ways regarded as being a failure. But had it worked, it would have absolutely turned the war around. I mean, the Germans would have been in disarray.
I hadn't done so much research over it the first time I went. And of course, when you turn up and you hear it as a failure, and but it's not to the residents, to the locals that historically saw what was going on, and the love they have for the airborne forces, and the perseverance and the resilience that they showed, it was incredible, unspeakably brilliant. Just beautiful memory of something so dark and tragic is their love and support for them.
And such a new part of the armed forces, really, the airborne divisions. So you look back on those things. If you see Second World War planes fly over, you think people crammed into these things and people just jumping out, not knowing where they're going to land, ready to fight.
I've had conversations with them about how they jump the caravan. They talk about this certain feet that they've got, and it's your jaw's hitting the floor because the height just shrinks, you know, from thousands of feet to 20,000, you know, to the canopy, you know, because I did suggest that I wanted to do a drop, and they took one look at me. You're going to have to get down to 15 stone, Lewis. Okay. You know, I'm 2 stone off wanting to, well, 2 stone off before hitting the ground like a stone. But I will do it because there's something about, you move out of that aeroplane. I've thought about, what must that be like? It really stiffens you when you think, God, how did they do that? And landing, and the proper way to land, or your leg gets snapped. And
yeah.
Oh, they are amazing. I love them.
I mean, and you'd be doing it with the idea there'd be people at the bottom with a cup of tea.
Coming up to you with a tray. Are you all right? How was that? It's rather windy up there, wasn't it? You go, there's your tea. It's somewhat cold because you took too long.
What a fantastic thing to put in.
Oh, thank you. Because I went to the club and they gave me a tie. They gave me an SOE tie to wear. And somebody who really was the real deal sort of kinked his head to the side, and I think he thought I was a Walter Mitty, you know, and he came up and said, "We've not met. Hello." And he's looking at the tie, because the tie was, it was a significant tie. It wasn't like I was wearing a Hereford thing, or you know, it was SOE, it was just a hilarious moment. I took the tie off quicker than they removed Michael Fagan from the Queen's bedroom, you know. It was, but they are amazing. They just, the conversation, they make you feel welcome. That's the thing. I've always found them just the most brilliant bunch to be with. And so learned as well. The conversations go into the esoteric and, you know, I remember one of them saying to me, "Everything that ever was, ever is, and ever shall be is happening right now." Things like that. They'll come away with phrases that you go, "What? Say that again? What does that mean?" You know, so it's schooling and great chat, really, you know.
Fantastic. All right, so that's number 3. We've got 2 left, Lewis.
Right. Well, the next one is track 9, Anakin defeats Sebulba, John Williams, the score to The Phantom Menace. That was another one of those ones where, as a kid, I was building toy sets, papier-mâché, you know, of bottles of iron brew, and you know, I was obsessed with Star Wars, and thanks to my parents buying me all the toys, it just became it was my little escape world in the hallway, just to sort of play all these different characters and Star Wars. I grew up with it, and it was the most beautiful thing for me, because my father, when he was diagnosed as having terminal cancer, he saw me get the part, which was a combination of audition and help. You know, Peter Serafinovich gave Robin Gerland my tape, not his, mine. Wow. And he said, "I gave him your tape." I was like, "Pete, what about yourself?" He said, no, we got around to that. But I thought it was the most generous thing an actor had ever done for me, you know. Yeah. He's a good soul, and I'm so grateful to him for that. But I got the audition, I got in, and he said, "You're the most bizarre man I've ever met," and got to audition and got the part. But The weird thing about this was that growing up, my father, when he wasn't on one of his 4 shifts that took him away on a Saturday morning, would be at the house, and my mother would go out the door to work, and he would put on, without fail, Rimsky-Korsakov, Scheherazade. So I've grown up with this beautiful music since I was about 9 or 10. And this track on, you know, the album, Phantom Menace, track 9, for about a minute, you have the strains of the familiar sort of Star Wars universe. And then there was a moment. Now, I clarify this with with the backing of a guy called David Chilton, who is a composer and worked for the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And I was with him in his studio, Essential Music, and we were working on my reel. And I spent months on this reel because I wanted the voices to be really good and you know, try different sort of shapes and, you know, like a wee story. It's when you could have a voice reel that lasted 6 minutes.
Yes, not people like, would listen to.
Exactly. Yeah. Not like 10 seconds now. But he said, oh, the CD's out. Of course, the soundtrack would be released prior to the movie, so you'd get an indication of what the film was about. So I raced around to HMV, got the CD, and here it was, standing in the shop. My goodness, I've got this character that John Williams has written a score for. And, it's, wow. And actually, it's called Anakin Defeats Sebulba. It blew my mind. I mean, I think, honestly, it was mental for me, that moment. So I go back around to Essential Music. We put it on. We play it the first, as I say, minute or so. It's the, you know, the strains, the coda, Star Wars, you know, here, there. And then there's this moment where brass comes in and the hair on the back of my neck just went up, and I just went, that's Scheherazade.
No.
That's, I just felt this weird.
And he never knew that then. He never knew that connection.
No. Well, this is the strange thing, because, of course, my father is dead now. This is 99. This is 2 years of, you know, but there came the opportunity where I was telling a BBC producer about it. He said, I think that's a great story. He said, I think we could, I'm going to try and get a show, because the SN, the Scottish National Orchestra, had an association with the BBC around Christmas, and they could put in this schedule of music and a little documentary to go along with it, where I get to meet John Williams and ask him a very tricky question, because you're basically saying, you know, what's that line? Success has many fathers. Failure is an orphan. You know, where I get to ask him, is this music? And I was counseled on this one where, you know, the person says, no, you don't say, did you, you know, you're not going to ask him if you, did you copy Rimsky-Korsakov? But using the word evocative.
It's like saying to Andrew Lloyd Webber, it's memory, that's Ravel's Bolero, isn't it?
Exactly that. So with that in mind, we've tailored exactly what I would say to him. I mean, I think I'd collapse with him. I just think he's just, oh, an amazing man.
Oh, yeah.
However, you know, and so in the end, they got so far as getting to Amblin and the production company, and they got some lovely letters back saying, look, you know, he's scoring Lincoln at the moment, and we don't know if we're going to be able to make it work. But to get that close, to have that, because I would really just like to know if it was inspired. But the closest I got to, I'm not imagining this, and creating some sort of a fanciful, oh, that's just like my dad, but, you know, and I'll bollocks, you know. The composer, David, went like that. Absolutely. He said, that is very, just, it's not long. It's only about 5-6 seconds.
There's a refrain,
exactly that. Just a lovely little moment. And I thought, maybe there is no such thing as a coincidence. You know, maybe this, I've got the hope of that for a brief moment. And
it's a fantastic thing. I mean, what a thing to have happened in your life. I mean, we all know about those obsessions and how those things can take you over. Mm. And you imagine yourself one day being near to it, as it were. Mm. But to actually be in it, be there, and then for it to be immortalized with a piece of music that's scored deliberately under that scene.
I immediately, it was my dad. I thought, wow, this is, why immediately did I automatically associate Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade? There was just some communication that was going on there that was on a level I can't fathom. And I felt that was personal for me, just that moment. And I'm maybe not meant to meet him and ask him, and can you remember what you were thinking about when you composed that? The only clue is actually that the film itself was about a trade dispute. That's the politics behind it. But in Korsakov's work, it's, you know, it's Arabian Nights, it's souks, it's markets, it's trading, it's about business as well as. And I thought, well, maybe that, I don't know.
I mean, traditionally in Star Wars, he's brought in little elements of what you would regard as not European or Western music. There's always little tones of them coming underneath, aren't there? So I think he'd traditionally done that. So you've made the hairs on my neck stand up.
Mate. Well, you know, weeks later was the weirdest thing, getting the part in Star Wars in 1997. 3 weeks later, I got a part in War of the Worlds, which was the second double album I owned. The first being Star Wars, and the second one being literally War of the Worlds with Jeff Wayne. I got to stand at the microphone that Richard Burton stood at and said, you know, where he said, no one would have believed. You know, my goodness, that moment, you know, and so and got to play The Martians, which made the album where Liam Neeson became no one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century. But I'm on that album. So there was a kind of weird time. And Paul Darrow, God rest him, he was in it with me as well and was trying to teach me billiards in Jeff Wayne's house. He was so funny, Paul. You know, Avon from Blake 7. That universe, the Star Wars world, I still work in it. I was Ewan McGregor's sound-alike in the video games for a while, Obi-Wan.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but they've got a guy in Los Angeles who's very, very good. You wouldn't tell him apart. But, yeah, so that one goes in, I think. I hope.
That does go in. That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Well, all we've got is one that you don't want now.
Airplane neck cushions. I hate them. My pal, he was actually the guy that told me that. His name was Kevin Shabby Neal. He was just a sweet man who worked in advertising, a bit of a legend. Wonderful commercials that he came up with. He worked on all those cigarette ads in the 80s, you know, huge budgets. Mm. But he gave up the cigarettes. Now, he was smoking heavily. And I said to him, look, why don't you come with me? We'll go on a writing course to Los Angeles, you know, a few days in LA, and we can brush up our writing and, you know, have a laugh. And I was only worried that he wouldn't survive the flight. But he went on patches, and he did. So we got him to Los Angeles. So we get there, we do the course. And on the way back, we nearly missed the flight. Now, we nearly missed the flight because he stopped off to buy a neck cushion. And I said, I've never liked these things. You stick them on you, and you end up just like twitching the neck from side to side. You spend the whole flight trying to find that position that you're just not going to sleep in. But he did this thing. He said, this thing, Lewis, I can't stand it. I said, what did you buy it for? You know, and the bloody labels rubbing against my neck. Who thinks these things up? So he gets the neck cushion and he bites it with his teeth and he rips the neck cushion off, and then bing bong, flight Virgin Atlantic. So we all have to, we need to go now. We're sort of running down the stairs, we're racing towards the gate, and I look behind me and there's Shabby with his neck cushion, but it's burst and all the baubles, the wee tiny polystyrene balls, have now pouring out along the corridor of the airport. Now, we get to the thing, we get to the door of the plane, and there's an Alsatian dog, and it's going, wah, 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 wah. Oh, Lewis, oh, Lewis, what's going on? The dog, wah, wah, wah. I said, Shabby, you're all right. But I'm saying, why is the dog barking? And the guy holding the dog is going, what is around your friend's neck? What has he got around his neck? I said, it's a neck cushion. No, the white stuff. I went, oh, no, they think you're smuggling a ton of gear down your shirt. And he's going to tell the dog it's baubles, it's polystyrene. So there was this huge ruckus, and we nearly never got on the flight. By the time we eventually did and sat down, the neck cushion had deflated. There was nothing left of it except for a wee lump at the side. He's right saying, I think I'll lean on this bit, Lewis. It was just an unbelievable thing. But so that if I could put a neck cushion in, and don't buy them, they're a waste of money.
Yeah, but what a lovely memory. Fantastic. I've got a friend in Tunbridge Wells who wrote a lot of adverts in the 70s and 80s and won lots of awards. And that simplicity of an advert, which seems to me to be like when you've got see it, say it, sorted, what's that? That doesn't rhyme. See it, say it, that's wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
It's wrong. Who let that through? And I think that standards have dropped. I once improvised the end of an advert. It was for a disinfectant. It was for Domestos, actually.
And I was Domestos. I was the Grime Minister with Rob Brydon.
But they couldn't think of an end line for it.
Right.
And I was talking, so you could either use this disinfectant,
yep.
Where for this, germs, life is a bowl of cherries. I said, whereas with Domestos, life is just a bowl.
Oh, very good.
But I think that sort of moment of inspiration, that's what they're looking for. All the time, those writers, and they have the ability to recognise it when it comes along.
That moment, and I think it's American Express. It's with American Express. Don't leave home without it. And now they've changed it to American Express. Don't live life without it. And I was like, no. That okay. So why? So what has happened that's made now? And you've got to live life. And the arguments that must have ensued around that. With Shabby, funnily enough, we used to have endless. discussions about this thing, about, I mean, I totally get that. See it, say it, sorted. For a start, it's really sibilant. See it, say it, sorted. I don't know. There's something in the scan. Doesn't work.
Doesn't work, no.
But we were in one of the many haunts of Soho one night. I mean, this couple, they came down from Leeds. They were sitting, chatting, and it was lovely. And they went into catering. And, do you have a business card? And Shabby leans and he gives them the business card and proceeds to destroy the strap. The strap was customized taste technology. And Shabby had a few bullet points going, customized taste technology. Who thought that up?
Well, I mean, we both did. What's wrong with it?
Well, it's terrible, frankly. I mean, it's customized taste technology. My teeth are shattered because of this. This is awful.
Oh, dear. And so that was the see it, say it, sorted moment.
Yeah, there have been some big mistakes. It's like it used to be Safeway, which doesn't exist anymore, but Safeway, everything you want from a store and a little bit more. That's a good line. But then they sang it. And the person who composed it wrote, Safeway, everything you want from a store and a little bit more.
Da-da-da-da. Yeah, I remember that.
The problem with singing it was that whoever sang it went, everything you want from a store or a little bit more, whore. And they said whore at the end. And once you'd heard it, you could not hear it.
Well, what's the one that, what's his name? Yeah, looky likey. What's his name? You know the guy. He's presenter now, and there's one on telly. I saw it go out, and it's Booking Geniuses. But it's not Booking Geniuses. Will you listen to this ad? I'll send you. You go like, Booking Geniuses. I'm like, sorry, wait a minute. That one went under the...
Yeah, many times. Many times you've been asked to do things and you think, so that's not right, is it? Lewis, you are fantastic. There's no doubt about it. And I love, the fact that you can do anything and everything. And long may you reign.
Oh, Mike, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for having me on. I was a bit nervous about this because you always think, well, what am I going to talk about? But you've made me feel very much at ease. And thank you so much.
Lovely. Keep very well.
You too, Mike. Always. Lots of love.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Lewis MacLeod. What a lovely man. I hope you enjoyed listening to him and attempted to repeat the experience with other guests. We have nearly 400 to choose from. Or why not go back to number one with Stephen Fry and listen to them all? It'll only take you a couple of weeks. Also, if you subscribe, you'll get every new episode as it's released. Although some listeners have suggested some of them have actually escaped, or should at the very least only be out on parole. You decide. If you want to get in touch about the podcast, then you can email us on mytimecapsulepodcast@gmail.com. That's mytimecapsulepodcast@gmail.com. Or follow me and My Time Capsule on social media and chat to us that way. We usually answer. The theme tune, written and performed by Past the Peas Music, is available to listen to in its entirety on Spotify. And this was a cast-off production for Acast, produced with reliably consistent care and skill by John Fenton Stevens. Right, I'm off to the park with my new dog, Jeff. Oh, he's brilliant. He's so easy to take care of. He's actually a cross between a retriever and a stick insect. So when you take him to the park, it's a doddle. You just sit on a bench and he fetches himself. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.